Well, I feel that, he's getting enough direction. And even though the boy may be well behaved and otherwise may be very nice, but don't judge a boy's solidity by his being nice. There are certain things that a boy is supposed to have besides the kind of refinement which presumably women can give him. You see what I'm trying to get at? And it's here that somehow, as far as you can, even in your school system, but above all, in whatever influence you have over the families, to demand, and sometimes, I don't know how, what sanctions you've got here, to flunk the boy or to keep him after school or who knows what, unless you have evidence of the father's entering that boy's life. And I think a lot of our religious education should be geared in such a way that the boy could not get a fully blown or developed religious education without some help of the father. And this, sisters, is also where you've got to get the priest into the act. They should do far more in the education and development of boys than they're doing. That was 3. 4. Comment on the need for not separating the unitive from the procreative roles of marital relations. I want to qualify and clarify what, after I finish this morning's lecture, which I try to squeeze an awful lot into about 62 minutes, and the risk is you're liable to miss something. I'm afraid I may not have made it sufficiently clear that all sex perversion consists in somehow separating either the unitive and the procreative from sex activity, or separating the unitive from the procreative in the marital act between husband and wife. In other words, perversion has all kinds of levels. Now, the most extreme form of sexual perversion is not merely the separation of the unitive from the procreative. It is the separation of both the unitive and the procreative from sex pleasure. See? Thus, masturbation is the most extreme form of sex perversion, theologically. Because it is just sex activity, narcissistic, just me, myself, and I, who enjoy this sex pleasure. There isn't even another person involved, notice, which would be homosexuality. Or a person of an opposite sex, which would still be fornication. This is what I should have developed, except that I didn't. This is pretty important for the full concept of sex perversion, which is partly what we're talking about. So the most extreme, the narcissistic type, where it's sex activity for the sake of sex activity, without even another person, the lowest. The second, where there is another person involved, but of the same sex, homosexuality, where there is some semblance of the unitive, but clearly the procreative is impossible. The next, still perverse, fornication, where you have a person of the opposite sex indeed, and the unitive element is presumably, that's what the girls tell me, the boy always said, "Won't you?" To prove that you love me, because I love you. They always use that language. Yet, the procreative, in the sense of procreating children who can then be nurtured and cared for, is excluded for the very simple reason that the girl who is, if a child is conceived, has the child. And what about the man? He withdraws. She has no guarantee of that child being cared for. And the same with adultery. Because by definition, adultery is with a person of the opposite sex, of course, but not one spouse. And both the woman then and the child, and in this case particularly the child, does not have any guarantee of being cared for by a father the way a child should. So there may be procreation, all right, but no procreative love. You follow that? No real procreative love. It's one thing to procreate a child. It's another thing to procreate it and to assure it the parental procreative love, which is absent in fornication and adultery. Now, the one up to the last contraceptive is still perverse, because even though it satisfies, and that's why it's so subtle, it seems to satisfy all the elements, right? This is the way they talk. Seems to satisfy all the elements requisite for sexual intercourse. Well, you don't have, it's not one person. It's two people of the opposite sex. And they're married. So what more do you want? Well, all right. Except they can talk till they're blue in the face about their intercourse, fostering their unity of love. Maybe it does. Maybe it does. But there is where the unitive is cut off from the procreative, because in one sense even fornication and adultery are better. You follow? Because at least a child may be conceived, even though he may not be loved. In fact, a man who has intercourse with a woman who is not his love, his wife, is showing selfishness for the child, because she knows, and the child will soon find out, though this man brought me into the world, he cannot say that he loves me. Because even though he may be my father, he is not the husband of my mother. You follow that? Now, in contraception, procreation and procreative love are rendered impossible. But we're talking about the procreative love. In other words, the love that a husband and wife should have, not merely for themselves, but for the potential offspring, which this expression of their love has as its connatural, built-in, intrinsic effect, they cut off. I should have said all that I just said, but I didn't in this morning's lecture. Number 5. What is the built-in logic of Christian teaching on sex so that one aspect is denied, the rest collapses? The reply here is, the answer is inherent in the question. Any aspect left out makes the result untrue. Well, I would ask, why? Why is there this built-in logic? Well, the reason is, and this is where we'll have years of theological study and development, we're on the edge of a new era in our understanding of love, as I think we mentioned in a previous lecture. But the one thing that we can say built into the logic of the Christian teaching on love is, love as Christianity understands it is always self-giving, self-sacrificing, self-effacing. And that you cannot, as in the case of contraception, where it's most subtle, I don't think we'll ever have to have an encyclical by the Pope condemning fornication. I don't think so. No matter how bad it gets, there's a kind of a natural instinct in most people, even though many commit fornication, to know that it's wrong. But contraception is more subtle. And the built-in logic is that when you're talking about Christian love, you dare not, you cannot remove the selflessness, the self-givingness from Christian love, no matter where you touch it, without destroying the essence of Christian love. And therefore, sexual love, which is sacred, must still be self-effacing, self-giving, and it cannot hide under any kind of nice words. Above all, and I hope I can express myself clearly enough, this sacrificial love, which is essential to all love as Christ understood it, as he teaches it, sacrifice is built into Christian love. Now, sexual love, if it's Christian, cannot hide its true Christian character under the guise of a non-Christian type of love. Because that's what they're talking about. It's the fostering of love between husband and wife, between H and W in my formulas. Between H and W. And they'll pile on the rhetoric and all the myriad ways in which husband should love his wife and how they can, all the wonderful things they can do for one another and how this intercourse helps to foster that mutual love. Who doubts it? Amen. Well, once you've said that, are you denying that there is another quality in this sexual love which is self-sacrificing? Unless love has the cross in it, it's not Christian. It's not Christian. And the cross in marital love for so many people is the cross of bearing children. Let's face it, let's tell them. Number 6. How should a teacher deal with such authors on sex morality as teach situation ethics? Some observations. Depends very much on the level of the group. Power of critical thinking should be developed, not mere questioning. Distinguish between the objective and the subjective. Situation ethics change principles, yet circumstances and situations do have a bearing on decision making. Yes, I think we better know as much as we can, sisters, not merely in, for example, saying that a man like Charles Carvin is teaching error, which, put the way I put it this morning, it is. And by the way, I went to quite some trouble to find the clearest statements that he's written a number of books, by the way. The clearest statements in which he formally and explicitly says, and he condones fornication, he condones adultery, he condones homosexuality, he condones masturbation. Right down the line. What's left? Nothing. On the other hand, it's one thing to say that. It's another thing to train people, and say the students, to think through the principles of our moral theology, which the principles don't change in different situations. Nevertheless, there are different situations which, without changing the principles, do demand, and this takes more work than most of us recognize, do change the way in which the principles are applied. Situation ethics, by the way, is here to stay in our culture. Do you know what situation ethics, of course, it means a lot of things. Let me just, before I leave this, and there were 8 questions I'd like to answer that have been posed here. Situation ethics, as the name implies, is that ethical system or attitude which says that in the last analysis, what determines the permission or the permissibility or the wrongness of an action is a situation in which I find myself. There really are no absolute norms of morality which are valid for all situations. You can never make a blanket statement, murder is wrong, adultery is bad. He will always say, it all depends. Now put that way, it's a little slippery, and you're not sure quite what they're saying. Here is, in a minute or so, my understanding of situation ethics, where it can be, I think, better understood. According to situation moralists, and Kirvin is one, they claim the only real determinant of morality is the motive or the intention that I have in doing what I do. It is not the action that I perform. So that even though by whatever norm of morality I may generally subscribe to, adultery is said to be bad. In other words, relations with a partner who is not my spouse is adultery. That's the classic definition of adultery. That in itself is not the strict norm, the absolute norm. The norm is not whether this woman or husband or man is my spouse, but why we have intercourse, you see? And provided the motive is high enough, deep enough, sublime enough, no matter how objectively bad the action may otherwise be, in this case, it becomes good. And thus between a couple that are not married, if they are really in love, they may have intercourse. That's what they're saying. What counts is your intention, not what you do. Not what, but why. That's the essence of situation morality. Here are some questions. Do all Christians, including non-Catholics, receive the sacrament of matrimony and the sacramental graces? Can you repeat the question? Do all Christians, including non-Catholics, receive the sacrament of matrimony and the sacramental graces? I qualify. All baptized people who have been validly baptized, if both are baptized at the time of marriage, so if both are validly baptized at the time of marriage, not after marriage, at the time of marriage, they receive the sacrament of matrimony. Period. If either or neither is validly baptized at the time of marriage, neither receives the sacrament. And thus a Catholic marrying a non-Catholic, if that non-Catholic is not validly baptized, neither the non-Catholic nor the Catholic receives the sacrament. Hope there's no surprise there. Neither receives the sacrament. You don't split this sacrament. As far as the sacramental graces go, that depends on their condition at the time of marriage. The valid sacrament of marriage is received if both at the time of reception are validly baptized. Do they have to know they're validly baptized? No. Do they have to believe anything? No. Could they be two baptized atheists and receive the sacrament? Yes. How's that? Two baptized atheists when they get married, receive the sacrament of matrimony. But now, by the way, that is important. Why? Because then until death, that bond is indissoluble. Okay? That bond cannot be dissolved. Later on, one of the two atheists rediscovers his faith, comes back, say, to the Christian faith, maybe converts to Catholicism. Too bad. That first marriage is indissoluble. Sorry, you cannot remarry. Now, the sacramental graces are something different. They must be in the state of grace at the time of matrimony to receive the sacramental graces. This, by the way, should be edged in red or underlined in black. They've got to be in the state of grace. What if they are not in the state of grace when they marry? Can they pick up the sacramental graces later on? Yes. But if they don't get into the state of grace, they're validly married, and this is a tough one, because they're bound by the law of indissolubility, but they don't get the grace. Which is one of the main reasons I so discouraged mixed marriages. She can never be sure that her husband is in the state of grace. Suppose he's baptized. All right. But they both receive the sacrament. So she's flooded with graces. But Jim, or Mike, her husband, doesn't get the grace. No wonder he behaves the way he does. You see the implications. Any questions on that before we go on, sisters? Yes, sister. I can't quite hear, sister. You are speaking, who is the Christian that first marries the non-baptized? Is it a Catholic or not? A Catholic person marries a non-baptized person, validly. Clearly, neither receives the sacrament, okay? They can be validly married with a dispensation. Now, your question is, I didn't quite, what happens to the... At the moment of that person's baptism, it's implied that they want to stay together as husband and wife, which is obvious. At that moment, at the moment of baptism, the sacrament of marriage takes effect. And they receive the sacramental graces. The moment of baptism. And there is then the implied renewal of, you know, the acceptance of each other in marriage. Sister? Pardon, sister, do you mind if we said we could take a little more time, if you don't mind? Okay, sister. How do you mean, sister, for Christians who... Yes. Now, are they staying together? Yes. Yes. On the other hand, here's a big difference. If two people are married, even though one was a Christian, but not a Catholic, and the other was not baptized, that marriage can be dissolved. Because it's not a sacrament. Now, on principle, the first type of marriage could also be dissolved. See, on principle. A Catholic marrying an unbaptized person, on principle, could be dissolved because it's not a sacrament. See, the only marriage which cannot be dissolved must have three qualities to it. Do you mind if we go into? Must have three qualities. Both must have been certainly and validly baptized at the time of marriage. Number one, both validly baptized at the time of exchanging their marriage vows. Secondly, the contract must have been a valid contract, a real contract, which means there must have been adequate knowledge and complete freedom in entering that contract. And thirdly, there must have been natural intercourse after the marriage contract. Natural intercourse after the marriage contract. Let me say a word about each. Both must have been validly baptized at the time of marriage. If either or neither was baptized, even though the marriage was valid, that marriage is dissolutable. Only a sacramental, consummated marriage can never be dissolved. All others can. So both must have been validly baptized. If either or neither was not baptized, thus, Isaac and Rebekah, two Jewish people, marry before a rabbi. Later on, Isaac wants to convert. He meets, which he shouldn't have, but he did. He met a Christian girl with whom he falls into love at any rate. Maybe that's the reason they got a divorce. So now they're divorced. He wants to become a Christian and a Catholic. Can his marriage with Rebekah be dissolved? Of course. That's the Pauline privilege. At any rate, first condition, both baptized. Secondly, must be a valid contract. Now, for a Catholic entry contract, there must be a priest or two witnesses with such modifications, and we know various things that dispensations and so on that are given. But for two Presbyterians, for example, or whatever they are, or two non-Catholics, a civil contract before a justice of the peace, two Presbyterians, that's a sacrament. Provided it is a valid contract, they want to marry each other. The biggest thing that I tell young people in teaching in college, the biggest thing I warn them against to make sure their marriage is valid, is that both are really free to marry the other. And the one thing that militates against the freedom of not a few marriages is that the girl is already pregnant, or at least she fears she's pregnant, and that's enough. And the one, by the way, who is under greater duress is not the girl, but the man. So, years later, if he can prove he did it under duress, that contract was invalid, and consequently, that marriage will be not dissolved, but simply declared null and void from the beginning. Third, in natural intercourse, it must be natural intercourse after the marriage contract between two baptized people, so that contraceptive intercourse does not consummate a sacramental marriage. In fact, it doesn't consummate any marriage. Suppose she starts taking the pill from a wedding night on, and some start, by the way, they tell me 2 weeks before taking the pill. Suppose they take that for 5 years, and successfully avoid having children. After 5 years, there had been a big three-priest wedding in the cathedral. That marriage can be dissolved. Natural intercourse alone consummates marriage. The intention, this is another angle on it, the intention to avoid having children ever and to use means to avoid them nullifies a marriage before it is contracted. Shall I read another? Is it all right, sisters? Now, we can have a cutoff time whenever you want to. If the law, I have 8 questions here. If the law of Christian marriage was so different from what was taught before, why didn't Christ get a more astounding reaction from the people? Well, I'm not sure how more astounding it would have to be. I think the reaction, somebody had her New Testament there, and was there somebody that was reading the New Testament? And who was it that told the Christ, it is better not to marry them? Who remembers? Was it Peter or was it one of the other disciples? At any rate, I think the reaction was about as astounding as you can make it. You know, there was better not to marry. Moreover, the reaction among the Pharisees, I think, was sufficiently astounding because they put him to death. They didn't like what he was teaching. And I think we should begin to teach this. One of the reasons why Christ was killed was because of his moral teaching. Because in most cases, people are not that concerned about dogma. It's when they are told they've got to do something. It's Christ's ethic that got him into trouble, not his metaphysics. Please comment on the status of Father Curran. Why is he permitted to continue teaching at Catholic University, which is a papal university? This is a $64,000 question. Father Curran's status is uncertain. This happens to be the summer. A lot of people are praying, hoping that he will not be teaching there next year. I got a long-distance call from Washington about 2 months ago from one of my Jesuit students who was doing his doctoral work there. And he was telling me, among other things, he said, you may be interested to know that Father Curran has just called back all of his doctoral theses that he's directing the students in their writing, because it seems he's under pressure to clean up or get out. And these students, of course, have been, just imagine if this thing goes on, see? These students have been writing theses which were plainly situation morality. So he was calling them back and requesting, would they mind changing certain things, because Curran is under pressure. The big question, of course, is the status not of Curran, but of Catholic University. You know the revolution that hit that university.